This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytech, brings you Blowing Bubbles. Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world. How are people living their bubble lives? Working from home, keeping kids entertained, and staying connected and getting exercise. And how are these things presenting us with the opportunities to find new ways of living? Every weekday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann, Shan Gallagher, and Mara Karatai reach out from their bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world. Broadcast on Otago Access Radio 105.4 FM and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz and sustainablelens.org, bringing connection, joy, kindness and peace in the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann. I am at Otago Polytechnic Te Pūkenga, and I am joined from Whakatane by Mara Karatai. Kia ora, Mara.
Kia ora, Sam. How's it going?
It's going very well indeed. How is your week going?
It's going very well. It's going to be a mad week of lots of governance, lots of writing, and lots of celebrating because I am a year post my gastric sleeve and 75 kilos lighter.
Whoa! Is that is that twice what you are, or are you less than that?
No, I'm actually less than half of my start weight now.
Wow! And it really has changed your life?
In every way. Not even, like, I just, in ways that I couldn't even imagine it would. It's been such a great experience.
That is
saving my own life.
That's a pretty good thing to be doing.
Yeah, I reckon.
And who are we introducing today?
It is my great pleasure to introduce Finn Boyle from Whanganui. He is a regenerative practice practitioner and a very nice man. Welcome, Finn.
Kia ora, Mara. Hi.
Kia ora, Finn. So, Finn, you had a big success last week. Tell us about that.
Yeah. A great success and a great relief. I polished off the last little bit of my Masters of Professional Practice that I've been working away on for the last 3.5 years. And yeah, finally, last nail in the coffin last week and sent it away. Feels very good.
Sent it away and it had a fantastic reception, I must say. I don't think I've ever sat in a presentation and been quite so wowed. So well done.
Oh, kia ora, Sam. Thank you.
Now,
yeah,
we
felt
are
really good. Felt really, really good.
Now, the second song that you chose, music, not even going to call it that, the second track that you chose lasts for 18 minutes. So we're going to play that under us in the next in the next section. So let's have your first music choice quickly. And now let's have Leonard Cohen, Avalanche. Why this one?
Why this one? Yeah, this is a very, very, very personal one. This is basically the song, the lyrics, which have gotten me through the last few months. I've been going through a very challenging, heartbreaking separation. And as I'm sure many, many people have experienced, the sounds of Leonard Cohen can be extremely cathartic, extremely soothing. And so playing this one to myself, on my ukulele and learn to sing it and just let it all out, let out the pain, let out the anger, let out the grief. Cohen's good for that, and this tune in particular just spoke to me, really carried me through these last few very trying months.
I step into an avalanche. It covered up my soul. When I am not this hunchback that you see, I sleep beneath a golden hill. You who wish to conquer pain, you must learn to serve me well. Side by accident, go down for your gold. The cripple here that you clothe and feed is neither starved nor cold. He does not ask for your company, not at the center of the world. When I am on a pedestal, you did not raise me there. Your laws do not compel me to kneel grotesque and bare. I myself am the pedestal for this ugly hump at which you stare. You who wish to conquer pain, you must learn what makes me kind. The crumbs of love that you offer me, they're the crumbs I've left behind. Your pain is no credential here, it's just the shadow of my wound. Begun to long for you, I who have no greed. I have begun to ask for you, I who have no need. You say you've gone away from me, but I can feel you when. Dress in those rags for me, I know you are not poor, and don't love me quite so fiercely now when you know that you are not sure. It is your turn, beloved, it is your flesh that I wear.
So, Finn, you're masters of professional practice. I know the answers to some of these questions, but I'm sure, as you always do, you'll surprise me with some of the answers. Mawira said it was on regenerative practice. Is that a good description?
Yeah, it kind of is a good description. It's a difficult thing to really describe and to define exactly what I was doing, but regenerative practice was the sort of the unifying theory, the unifying philosophy, and particularly the unifying sort of lens and frame through which to make sense of my work and the sort of ideas that I was putting out there. Yeah.
Unusually for someone in professional practice, you barely mentioned your work contexts in your presentation. Was that deliberate?
Somewhat deliberate. Yeah, I did mention them a little bit, and I did pull on stories from those contexts, but the important thing is the stories, really, and not the context, not the work so much. So I spoke about and sort of pulled on my experiences across three different areas of my professional practice, one being my work in drug harm reduction with the organisation Know Your Stuff NZ, another working in Otago Polytechnic and sort of around ecological
regeneration and yeah, sort of institutional design systems. And then another context I sort of named as basically leadership development, really, specifically with youth, well, primarily with youth, and primarily in the kind of context of adapting to the challenges of climate change and rising to that challenge. And the sort of the quest that I was on in this research was to make sense of what are the patterns that underlie them. So it was not about making sense of the specific practices in the organization or the specific sort of org itself, but really about like, how is it that I can connect all of these dots? And so what are the like the fundamental, the essential patterns and theories and rhythms which are common to all of these areas, and how do they contribute to each other? And the way that I can make sense of that is not by, you know, trying to equate drug harm reduction with building soil and compost. That's not the point. It's about looking at the sort of values and rhythms and patterns underneath all of those things which inform each other. So yeah, the sort of work itself is not really very important. And the way that I was exploring all of this was really through a very, very autoethnographic lens, and totally looking at the my experiences of those places, of those cultures, of those organizations, and what's going on in there. And so, yeah, the sort of work itself, it's just not really the point, I suppose.
We should probably take a step back and ask, what is regenerative practice?
Yeah, it's a good question, and an ongoing question for me of what on earth is regenerative practice. Regenerative practice to me is most easily approached, like in terms of understanding it, is most easily approached from understanding sustainability. I think a lot of people have a decent understanding of what might be meant by sustainable practice. And then regenerative practice sort of is this idea of positioning something a little bit beyond sustainable practice, going towards like, not just can we do less harm and sort of sustain what is currently, but really stepping into actually how can we generate more good and more life, and specifically how can we regenerate the things which have been harmed, the ecosystems, the cultures, the systems at all levels and layers of our world. How can we like really sort of regenerate vitality and life within all of these systems? So one of the ways I kind of think about it is like, take what we might know of sustainability and add more perspectives to it, add a very personal perspective to it, add a very cultural perspective to it, add a like spiritual or mystical perspective to it, and then, you know, what does sustainability become there? To me, it becomes regenerative practice.
If it's about more good, how do you differentiate it from whatever it is that I might be doing, which I'm doing for a purpose? I might be doing the thing that might be seen as being quite destructive, but as the person doing it, I'm not doing it just to be silly or evil. How do we separate that out, or how do we identify that's extractive, that's sustainable, that's regenerative? Is it as simple as a continuum like that?
Maybe. Can I ask you to flesh that out a little bit more, Sam? Like, can you give an example maybe of a kind of practice or work or something that might fit what you're describing there?
Yeah, well, so I've been writing about the idea of using regenerative practice in computing. And we have quite a lot of people, you know, working in computing that don't care about sustainability in any form. But then there's quite a lot of people who would say they're doing sustainable practice because they're doing something that's environmental. They might be doing the control system for a sewage plant or something. And I think regenerative is something more than that.
Yeah. So that's a really interesting thing. And I think that it's a great way to understand one of those differences with regenerative practice as well, is like, because it really intentionally tries to make sense of and engage with many complex aspects of a system or of a practice. Regenerative practice might look at something like a sewage plant, and we might just decide that the sort of physical infrastructure that the sewage plant is good enough, and that's not the thing that we're going to change. But taking a regenerative approach to engaging with or developing a sewage plant system or something might actually begin to look at much more diverse factors than you would have before. Instead of looking at like, okay, well then how is the organization which is running that sewage plant, what sort of systems and values are being upheld and practiced and applied within the organization behind that? Or maybe it's looking at okay, we accept that right now this is good enough and that we are happy that just doing less harm with our sewage, making sure it isn't harming our environment around us, is like good enough, we're satisfied. But what if we start planning 50 years in advance and beginning to look at actually what might, you know, the next generation of sewage systems begin to look like? Is there a way that we actually could fundamentally change our entire approach to handling these resources, these materials, and begin to look at what might a truly beneficial way of handling these be? You know, trying to challenging ourselves to step away from all we can do is less harm and try to come to grips with an approach which might lead us towards every system that we design and build and engage with is actually actively creating and bringing vitality of life into our world.
Because when you were working at the Polytech, you were developing the composting system, and I remember you going to a city council, I think it was, meeting and seeking a grant for it and saying, well, we could get this for whatever it was, $100,000, we could buy this machine that does our composting, or we could have set up this collection of buckets, and it would, because that would have to engage the people.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so that's quite a good example of a regenerative approach as opposed to a sustainable approach, where if you're to sort of look at it on a spreadsheet, the system is almost identical. It, you know, captures all of the materials from this community, from this landscape, and it turns it all into compost and it puts it all back into gardens. Like, if you look at it from that quite reductive standpoint, then it is essentially the same system, but one of them is a machine that takes very, very little human input and very, very little community engagement, and the other is a complex system that relies on relationship, engages with place and people and culture, and chooses to actively engage in that more complex web of relationships, recognizing that in those relationships lies greater potential for life-giving goodness, as opposed to the more simple, more efficient, more traceable value that a mechanized or industrialized approach might take.
You mentioned a spreadsheet then, and before you mentioned spirituality, because one of the early framings of your research, your quest, as you described it, was the monk in the boardroom and the accountant in the permaculture garden, and coming to terms with your identity and what the role was. And that's what the research was actually about, rather than the technicalities of how do you do regenerative practice. So where did you get to in terms of what does it mean in terms of your identity?
Where did I get to in terms of what does it mean my identity? When I begun this research, I was coming from a place of, I'd been in years of study before that and done Leadership for Change program, and through that had sort of begun to identify those identities that I hold, those different sort of ways of understanding myself. But at that time it was kind of a bit of a discrete network of identities. You know, I sort of saw like this me doing this work in this organization and this me doing this work and that, and they were kind of separate in a way, and the process and the sort of inquiry that I've gone through over the last few years has really helped me to integrate all of those different aspects of myself and make sense of how they are cohesive, how they are deeply, deeply connected, and the strength of that connection. And like fundamentally, one of the ways that has changed is rather than describing those identities as, or those roles as specific to a job or specific to an organization, now I sort of feel more connected to the idea of these as like clumps of vocation, clumps of like capability, that, you know, one of these vocations is really about sort of facilitation and like group work, and another of these vocations is really about the like sort of highly technical, highly nerdy, highly procedural expertise or practice. And so, yeah, rather than looking at it as these different roles discrete like that way, it instead becomes about the sort of actual processes that I engage with and understanding those as a more coherent sense of identity.
You presented your thesis as a game and a video, and what started out as a little bit of writing and turned into a lot of writing. What's the role for you in terms of that thinking about how to communicate things?
Yeah. So I did choose to base it all basically on a game, and that the major way I wanted to describe and showcase that game was through video work and kind of the performance of me playing the game. And it fundamentally came from a place of feeling a bit limited in my ability to communicate in written word, and wanting to be able to bring the depth and richness and the sort of wholeness, basically, of me into my communication of my thesis. And so looking for other pathways to be able to to be able to communicate to people in a way which, you know, meant that the requirements of a master's degree, but also held my sense of kind of authenticity and my sense of connectedness, basically, to the work that I was putting out there. It can be difficult for me to feel really connected to words on a page, but it's much more easy for me to feel connected to a sort of a board game, which is a richly expressed form of communication. You know, pulls on visual, pulls on symbolism, pulls on metaphor and archetypes, and all of this, it all wound up in an aesthetic which I could really sort of choose. But it's very difficult to capture all of those values and communicate them through a thesis, which it's difficult to get away from it being, you know, black words on a white page.
So tell us about the game.
Yeah, the game. Echoes of Wisdom is the game that I created. It's, the name in itself is kind of an aspirational thing. It is fundamentally a game of storytelling. It is a way of allowing people to find the stories and kind of claim the stories, the stories which hold wisdom, the stories which hold insight and knowledge and transformation, which we all have, but sometimes we don't own that. Sometimes we don't, you know, don't allow ourselves to kind of actually tell that story to ourselves, and especially tell it to other people. So it's, firstly, it's a way of pulling those stories out of our lives, out of our work. And then the other aspect of it is facilitating a process which allows people to like retell those stories, to find out how the wisdom and the insight captured in those stories can be reapplied into a new situation, into a new challenge, into a new scenario. And that is really about recognizing that for me, it came from a place of, as I mentioned before, trying to make sense of how to bring, you know, knowledge and practices from one area of my life into another, which holds and builds on that value. And so the game is really about facilitating that process. It's about challenging people to find a new way of telling a story, find a new ending for that that story, maybe is one way of thinking about it.
And the cards, the sets of cards, so some of them are, I don't know, the insight cards, I think that's what they're called.
Yeah, yep.
And some others are action cards. So the insight cards have got a little image, which are generated with AI.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so I developed a set of cards for each of those realms that I work within, each of those contexts of my professional practice. And through my reflective practice and making sense of all those stories that I have lived and learned, I captured all of those on one of these cards each, and then tried to sort of translate them into the essence of that story, the essence of that insight. And one of the ways I did that was using an AI art generator tool. I used the DALL-E 2 tool, which definitely has some ethical questions around its use, but I think right now I can feel okay in using it as I did, which was as a research tool and for a non-commercial purpose as well. But yeah, it was really, really fascinating, the actual process of using that that tool. I had no idea. I went into it thinking that the tool would be mostly as a way of getting to an image, and that the image would be the valuable thing that would come from it. But what I quickly discovered is that actually the process of generating the images, the process of this weird sort of dialogue with the machine, was extremely, extremely valuable, really, really insightful, and really added another layer to that reflective practice and to that storytelling thing, the strange layer of a machine dialogue, sort of cybernetic process, or cyborg process, rather.
Talking about interacting with a machine, we have had running underneath us for 18 minutes, Clipping, which is your second track. Their track, can't call it a song, Piano Burning. Why did you want us to listen to this one, Finn?
It's a great question. So, yeah, this is the sound of a piano burning. And there's sort of multiple reasons to this. One, I think it's absolutely fascinating, and I would definitely challenge your assertion that this is not a track or not music or something. I think it can be music. It's just maybe music played by fire rather than music played by people. But why? That's a lot. There's so much to it. The major thing is that actually I really wanted to share some of Clipping's music because they're just one of my favorite groups right now. But frankly, every single other song that I look for in their repertoire is far too obscene to be able to share here on OAR. And so I looked for something else. And really, it's hoping that this might be a little foot in the door, which allows other people to go and explore their discography, because it is absolutely spectacular. They're a very, very, very interesting hip-hop group from the States, making very interesting music. It's aggressive and violent and horrible in many, many ways, but in a way which is completely self-aware and extremely intentional, and like the level of craft and mastery in that pursuit is unbelievable. They are spectacular. So really, really, I think it's a beautiful thing. And a little bit of history in terms of piano burning. It has been a practice in sort of avant-garde music since the 60s, and it was actually a New Zealand composer, Anea Lockwood, who first wrote the piece called Piano Burning, recorded it, and many people since then have covered it, if you will. So this is not an original idea.
Bubble sprite of the forest of Orokinui, Dunedin's favourite goddess, Tahu Mackenzie.
Kia ora koutou, nga mihi aroha nui kia koutou, ko tahua hou. I hope you're all having the best day, beautiful superstars in your beloved universes. And I really hope, wherever you are and whatever's happening around you, this journey that we're all on together is proving to be very rewarding, very sustaining, and illuminating for you more and more each day, who you are, a triumph of nature's art, perfect, unique, and here making things better. Thank you. Now, I know that for us all, the last several years have been very tough, so it's so important that we give ourselves and each other the love, the kindness, the compassion, the time, the space, the energy, the support that we all need and we all deserve. I know for myself, the living world is a constant companion and comfort to me, and I speak to you now from my heart's home, Orokonui Eco Sanctuary, as the wind is gently rustling the leaves of the trees that I'm gazing at and all their differences, all their beauty, of course, serve as reminders of our own myriad forms throughout our lives, how to welcome and be grateful for each one. I know that we've all moved through several different times of transition in our lives, and particularly over the last several years, we've had to make quite fast and intense changes and transitions. And so it can be a great gift for us when we have the opportunity to slow down and take things slowly, do one thing at a time, really be present with that action and really enjoy our powers of observation, really tuning in with our five senses and appreciating how far we've come. It can be a great gift to ourselves in these moments when we're doing the dishes or we're sweeping the floor or we're making someone a cup of tea to look back over our lives and think of all those decisions that we've made. And of course, all those decisions really were the right decisions, because here we are right now, just in the place that we're meant to be. And of course, throughout the last several years, we have been in positions where those decision-making powers have changed in the way that our lives flowed, had to change. And so now it's such a gift, of course, to ourselves to really relish those moments where we can choose to do things for ourselves in ways that really nourish us. So I hope that for you, you're finding moments in time where you can slow down and give yourself that gift of your own perception, your own power to enshrine every moment with your own unique set of eyes, your own unique consciousness. And of course, fundamentally, we are this awareness, we are this consciousness. So when we can really take a step back from the hustle and bustle of our lives and all the many different ways of being that we have to move through each day and just relax back into that awareness that we are, it's such a relief. And of course, for me, being able to speak with you and be part of the show has been immensely helpful. So I want to say a huge thank you to Sam and the whole Blowing Bubbles team for having me. Really, for me, this show has given me an opportunity to experience things quite differently and to have that opportunity to take a step back and recalibrate and share my thoughts with you all. And it's a great pleasure and privilege to get to do that. Another thing, of course, that we can do, which can be really helpful, is allow our body to lead the way. And this is a lovely companion that we have in our lives, our bodies, that help us to move through life and constantly are there supporting us. And when we give our body the opportunity to lead the way, it can be again just really tuning in with those senses and finding that calmness, that peace, that serenity within via one of those senses or several of those senses. And for me, that can really be sound. So at the moment, I'm just really enjoying hearing the wind gently rustling. So I hope for you, you can find some really helpful things for yourself, and I'll look forward to talking to you again soon. Thanks so much. Ka kite.
You're listening to Blowing Bubbles. We're talking with Finn Boyle.
Finn, I listened with great interest around how you define a regenerative practice. And at the moment, I'm doing a lot of work with young people in climate anxiety kind of spaces, and gosh, they're cynical, and for so many good reasons. They've got every right to be cynical, and I guess my first question is, what happens when we can't restore what's lost and there is no way of bringing back getting the gains that we're talking about in regenerative practice? What happens then?
Yeah, fantastic question. And I really connect with the background of that in a big way, Maura. When I started this whole inquiry, I was very much in a feeling place. It was aligned with that. It was really coming from an overwhelming sense of not hopelessness, but certainly despair. It's very alive in me, in making sense of how to move forward, how to respond to the compounding crises of climate and ecological destruction, and there's so many different factors there. And so I started out and really trying to, I was aiming very specifically at that, looking through this framework of deep adaptation as a way of trying to come to grips with that, especially come to grips with it in groups. And yeah, the need for me personally to be able to engage with the work I was doing around climate change and do that in a way which felt healthy was a major driver for me. And so, yeah, that question, exactly what you've just asked, has been core to my journey this whole time. What I feel regenerative practice offers to that is it includes the well-being of the group and of the community, and it includes the well-being, you know, and I think that really comes from quite a complex idea of what well-being means, including psychological, mental, emotional, spiritual well-being, is very much included in regenerative practice's understanding of well-being of self as well. And so to me, regenerative practice offered a pathway and offered a set of frameworks that could include my well-being as I did this work as fundamental to, you know, a marker of success of the work itself. Yeah.
If we look at regenerative practice through that lens, which has self as having importance, where does the planet-centered part come in? Because I think about design, I think about this a lot in design. And we interviewed a few years ago, we interviewed Ron Wakari, who wrote Design for a Non-Human-Centered World. And that had a profound impact on my thinking. But yet here we are still in 2024 with a planet in crisis, with the planet is burning was the headline 2 weeks ago, and it is literally around the world. We're still designing for us, and we're still seeing ourselves at the center of solutions instead of actually design for the planet and design at the center of everything. How do we get to that place in regenerative practice?
So there is this framework within regenerative practice, which I have used extensively throughout my research and my thesis and how I've communicated it all, and it's also really core to the design of the game that I built as well. And that is this framework called the three lines of work. Basically, it's visualized as three circles nested within each other. That nestedness, the sort of hole being inside of another hole, being inside of another hole, is my way of understanding how we get to or between the well-being of self and the well-being of the wider system, the well-being of the planet, of Papatūānuku and beyond. And I don't know if it's very easy to grasp, but now that I have grasped it, it just feels so essential and fundamental that it's really obvious, but I'll try to kind of communicate this. But the idea that these nested circles, these systems, in a, well, there's all this nerdery around it. If you're interested in it, you can go look up what Kostler called a holarchy. But really, it's about these interdependent systems, which are, you know, they are reliant on, you know, completely dependent on the greater whole, which encapsulates them, and they're also completely dependent upon the lesser whole, or the aspect which is subsumed within their wholeness. Maybe a better way of understanding this is really in a biological way of understanding our bodies. You know, I am a whole system within me. I have all of these organs, and each of my organs is kind of discrete. You know, you can define what my kidneys do, and you can talk about the whole system, which is a kidney. And then within a kidney, you might also have a specific cell, and that cell is also a whole. And each one of these layers is alive and has its own life and modi and you know, complexity within it, but they're also completely and utterly dependent upon each other. My kidney cannot exist without me. I cannot exist without my kidney. Well, not both of them, at least. and so same goes for the cells which make up that kidney. And so to me, this framework, this idea of these systems nested within each other, helps me understand how I am completely and utterly dependent upon the greater whole, the ecosystem, the planet that I live within, and simultaneously it is completely and utterly dependent upon me as a part of it to be well, to be thriving, to be alive and dynamic. Does that begin to
offer something? It does. How do we simplify that in a way that we can bring some certainty about the future to our rangatahi who are really struggling with multiple anxieties, not just climate anxiety, multiple anxieties, but the climate anxiety seems to be at the core of all of it. Like, how do we simplify that and give them some agency in being part of a solution?
Yeah, I hear that. The thing that sticks out for me in your question there is certainty. And that's actually, once again, is where I really began in this inquiry, was trying to make sense of the value of certainty and when certainty becomes a crippling thing that we cling to, and maybe searching for certainty is really inappropriate. And that is kind of where I arrive at now, is that I feel like I have developed over the last few years a real capability of uncertainty, and that has brought me a lot of peace and a lot of agency as well, because rather than trying to stabilize my idea of the future so that I can plan for it, so that I can prepare for it, I have been able to grow my comfort and my sort of adaptiveness and responsiveness to be able to sit within uncertainty. And I think it is it feels unquestionable to me that our future is uncertain. That is not something I feel like we can change. It never was, but now it feels particularly apt. And I really feel like within that understanding of the future comes a place of, rather than trying to deal with certainty and find it, to find the comfort within that, is how do I live in a way which, and respond in a way which feels healthy and well and balanced, but also does that within uncertainty.
I like that position, actually, because I think about the things we can hang our hats on, the certainties of life, are things like neoliberal economics and its demand that we continue to grow, and a whole lot of rules put in place that enable the really destructive practices of industry, but have that green lens on them that looks like they're all trying to make a difference. Those are the certain things in life at the moment that they will continue, and yet they are the biggest part of the problem. And so I like the idea of sitting with uncertainty and letting that be the place of comfort. How do we create some sort of, how do we make that be part of education for kids? Because that's not what education's about. Education's about certainty. It's about absolutes. It's about you will think in this way at this time and you will answer this question with that answer.
I think conversations like this are really important, highlighting the fact that certainty is a thing which is, you know, it's a human construct. It's an idea that we have created. And I would agree that, you know, as you named, it's neoliberal capitalism and it's industrialized engagement with the world that relies on certainty. It's all built upon this idea that we uphold about certainty. But, you know, as now physics can tell us, certainty is not really much of a thing. When you get down to the quantum level, certainty is no longer there. And so I feel like it really comes from unraveling that story of certainty, unraveling that actually anything in the world has a set, you know, definable, certain outcome to it, and therefore sort of reclaiming uncertainty, reclaiming emergent patterns and properties as these are actually the normal things. This is what life is built upon. You know, a tree does not have a certain idea or a certain form that it is trying to create as it grows. That's not how trees or life works. A tree has an essential form to itself, which it expresses in response to its environment, in response to the rhythms of the world around it. That's what creates the form of a tree. That's how a tree emerges into the world. But it is not the pure or the perfect form of a tree which every tree is aspiring to become. That's not how it works.
And that brings in again this person-centered approach or this human-centered approach to design, is that we take the tree that we think is how a tree should be, and we try and replicate that using its genetics and somatic embryogenesis and other processes to create an exact replica of that tree. Because it does what we think a tree should do. And in all of our natural world, that's what I'm seeing at the moment is us and our design. What brought you on this journey? Why did this start for you?
Ooh, that's a very difficult question. Can we go back to how do we get people engaging with certainty? That's my
question.
What brought me on this journey? I don't know if I can really name it. It's been an ever unfolding thing, ever unfolding path. But certainly there is, I can only thank, you know, the people who have been around me and supported me and pushed me in directions of thought and idea and questions. Engaging with great people and people asking interesting, challenging questions. And paying attention to what they're paying attention to. One of the people I would really name there as a very, very significant influence in this thing of like uncertainty and emergence and the sort of the true patterns that life holds is Nora Bateson. She's been a huge, huge influence on my world. Amazing thinker, amazing writer. Yeah, beautiful, beautiful work out in the world, all grappling with these questions.
If you were to sit and talk with her right now, what would you ask her?
Oof. The first thing that comes to mind is, how on earth do you write so beautifully? Having just tried to write something which would really express the like essence of my world, my internal world, in my thesis, I look at the way that Nora Bateson writes and her ability to communicate like extremely technical, extremely complex ideas in ways which are like so poetic and so enjoyable and really beautiful. Like, just how do you do that? And do you have any tips on how to develop that capability of being able to write in a way which is really poetic and alive?
I need to interrupt and bring this conversation to a close, and we're going to go quickly through the questions to end the show. What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years, Finn?
Ooh. Success. I'd say moving away from Waitapuati, Dunedin, leaving my home, leaving the nest that has kept me safe and well and comfortable for many years. I made that choice about 2 years ago, and it's been extremely successful. It's been very good for me.
Even though we miss you.
And I miss Waitapuati as well.
What's your superpower?
Ooh. Our favorite childhood superpower is this my real superpower or my aspirational superpower?
You can have both. If you tell me the aspirational one first, I'll ask you for what your real one is.
Okay. Aspirational one is to be able to like stop time, but only for the purpose of like just pure humor and chaos, really. Like the thought of being able to stop time, run around the world for a year and like paint polka dots on all
and move things slightly.
Yeah, totally. Just like the jester's ability to stop time.
And your real superpower?
Probably to be a chameleon, to be extremely adaptable, to be able to fit in and understand what's going on around me and find out how to be a part of it.
So do you consider yourself to be an activist?
I certainly have considered myself to be an activist, and yeah, I think that's still part of my identity. Yeah, I'm an activist.
So what motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
Both beauty and pain and their connection. The beauty that I see in the world and just the ridiculous, outrageous glory of it all is very, very energizing. And the pain of seeing that compromised, and the anger and righteousness that comes from that and wanting to do something about it.
I think that's one of the most poetic answers we've ever had for that question. So what's the biggest opportunity or challenge that you're looking forward to in the next year or so?
I have a, this is once again, very, very personal. That's a boring answer. I've got a cooler one, which is completely and utterly overhaul the Misuse of Drugs Act and all drug policy in Aotearoa. That's what I'm looking forward to. And that's the big challenge. Yeah, it's on my radar now. We've sort of found a bit of stability in my work with Know Your Stuff NZ, and now looking for, we achieved all of our goals basically over the last few years. So now we're trying to set ones that we might not actually be able to achieve. And so, yeah, completely changed drug policy in this country.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Ooh. Once again, on the theme of sort of drug policy and drugs generally, advice is to be curious about a drug that you might have been, you know, have an idea that you know about, or specifically that, you know, the people who might be using a drug, that you have a set idea or, you know, a predetermined knowledge about what that person is, what that drug is, and what their behavior is, and to be curious about that and question it.
Thank you for that. Moira.
You had me at the be curious bit. That is, the world needs more curious people. Finn, it has been an absolute joy to talk to you today. I really appreciate your openness and the intelligence of your answers and your eloquence and how you expressed how you feel about the world around us right now. And I just really want to thank you for your time and for you being you so unashamedly and unapologetically wonderfully you. Kia ora.
Kia ora, Mavira. Thank you.
Thank you. The boy will never learn to run.
You've been listening to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. Brought to you by the Blowing Bubbles team, who are brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, Te Pūkenga. We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio, Wednesday afternoons at 3, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz. You can find us on Facebook. This is Colour Hour of Gold. We had a contribution today from Tahu McKenzie. I'm Samuel Mann with Mawira Karatai, and from Whanganui, we've been joined by Finn Boyle. That's Blowing Bubbles. We hope you enjoyed the show. Mati wa.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.